It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A recent UN report on climate change predicts dire consequences by 2040 if we don't do something about it. What is your response to the recent UN study? Were you surprised? What questions do you have about the latest research? Are you skeptical of what you hear? What do you want to know more about? Do you take actions yourself to lessen your carbon footprint? And what actions would you like to see on a national or global scale? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Diana Liverman is a Regents Professor of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona. She co-authored the recent report by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And a quick note, she taught at the University of Wisconsin-Madison early in her career. Diana, welcome to the Morning Show.
Good morning.
So the headlines are, you know, this is a 72-point bold type, catastrophic, devastating. How dire is the situation you detail in this report?
Well, I think what people are finding most challenging about the report is the goal of the report is to see if we can keep global warming under 1.5 degrees centigrade, so 2.7 Fahrenheit. And that actually would not be devastating. If we can limit warming to that sort of level, we wouldn't see particularly large changes. I think what people are finding shocking is that in order to do that, we're suggesting that we have to cut our greenhouse gas emissions very, very dramatically in order to achieve that 1.5 degree goal. And that would mean pretty much stopping using fossil fuels, coal and oil and gas, by 2050. So, and then I guess what we're looking at is we also look at, well, what happens if we don't limit warming to this 1.5 degree level? What would that do to ecosystems and human health? And what we show is even if we just went up half a degree from 1.5 to 2 degrees of warming, that that would have some very serious implications. For example, tropical coral reefs would probably disappear at that 2 degree level. We could probably keep them going at 1.5.
So what is different about the timeline this analysis outlines compared to past predictions?
So there are a couple of things that are different. One is the IPCC has never explicitly done this comparing 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees. We've never looked specifically at how much difference does half a degree make. The other thing is the last report was done almost 5 years ago. And so now what we're showing is because we've continued to emit greenhouse gases, that we have a much shorter period in which to act. And we're sort of more locked in to a pathway that could take us to 3 or 4 degrees if we don't make these drastic cuts in emissions. I think the other thing is that the pathways that we look at in the report now look at a very broad range of technologies that might be needed to reduce emissions, and those haven't been looked at in quite as much detail. But we were asked a very specific question in this report. This is a special report, which is, can we limit warming to 1.5 degrees, and how much more would it cost to do that than, say, go 2 degrees? And what would we save? How much both money and lives and ecosystems are saved by capping warming at 1.5?
I think for a lot of people, the numbers here are maybe a little different, a little difficult to understand. When you think, okay, 1.5 degrees Celsius, that really doesn't sound like a lot. And I think that's one of the things people have difficulty kind of wrapping their brains around. Why is this so crucial? 1.5 degrees difference between now and, say, 20, 30 years from now. It's hard to understand why that makes such a difference. Could you explain that, please?
Yeah, well, in the report, we document some pretty serious impacts, even at 1.5 degrees. And, I mean, one other important thing that we talk about in the report is that we show that the world has already experienced 1 degree of warming. And we can see some of those impacts already in terms of extreme heat waves, droughts, changes to some of the ecosystems that people care about. So we've already had some impacts at 1 degree. When we look at half a degree more or 1 degree more, we really do see some serious global impacts. So, for example, up to going, if you look at 1.5, you're going to see about 8% of ecosystems across the world, tropical forests, grasslands, woodlands, they actually shift their range even with just half a degree. And then if you get warmer, you start to lose species. And I already mentioned tropical corals. You lose about 90% of them even at 1.5 degrees, but you lose all of them if you go to 2 degrees. Another example would be human health, where even a half a degree of warming can increase the area where malaria thrives. And, of course, malaria is one of the world's biggest killers. And just at half a degree, you get areas becoming malaria-prone that were not before. And that can result in millions of people becoming sick and also children dying. So there are even every half a degree of warming matters. That's one of the things we found out in the report.
Let's talk about the causes of this rapid warming. You mentioned fossil fuel use. What else contributes to greenhouse gas emissions, which we're told play a major role in climate change?
Well, some of the other causes that we look at in the report are deforestation and land use change, because as we cut the tropical forests, we're releasing the carbon that's been stored in those for decades into the atmosphere. And that's carbon dioxide. But there are also other gases that we look at. So another one would be methane. And that one's fairly controversial to reduce because it's very much associated with the food system and with the livestock population. So one of the options for slowing warming would be to eat less meat, for example, or to eat less beef and eat more chicken if you want to make a more moderate change. Methane is also associated with rice production. And then there are a number of industrial gases which we can actually cut quite quickly and they don't stay in the atmosphere very long. And those are associated with a variety of industrial processes. So the food system is actually quite a significant source of greenhouse gases, depending on how you calculate it, maybe up to 15-18% of the greenhouse gases that are going into the atmosphere. But it's the fossil fuels and especially coal that are the largest emissions of greenhouse gases and the ones that need to be cut most steeply. So the report concludes that in order to limit global warming, we've got to cut carbon dioxide by almost half in the next 12 years. And then to get to what we call net zero, which is not no fossil fuels, it's having some fossil fuels, but you have to compensate that with things that take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can get back to that.
Well, yeah, we'll continue our discussion. And also, I want to talk, I want to hear you on the subject of how this affects our economy. Diana Liverman is professor of in the School of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona. She co-authored the recent UN report examining the latest data on climate change. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We are talking about a recent report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And we have one of its authors with us. Wondering what actions you are taking, if any, to lessen your carbon emissions. What actions would you be willing to take? And what actions would you like to see on a national or global scale? 800-642-1234. My guest is University of Arizona Regents Professor Diana Liverman, who is one of the co-authors of this report. Let's go to the phones. Todd is with us in Green Bay. Todd, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Good morning. Most of the information that comes out about climate change, I know, has been via computer-generated models. And most of those have usually found that from Michael Mann's hockey stick to the East Anglia reports in Britain to even NOAA's research, the numbers have been fudged in order to support the global warming argument. And what I'm wondering about is if there is any, I've got two different points, but wondering if there is any other more empirical evidence available. And the second point that I wanted to make is that about probably 7 or 8 years ago, Al Gore addressed some congressmen about global warming, and the room was packed with so many journalists and so many cameras clicking, you could almost not hear him. Less than 1 hour later, Bjorn Lomborg, who wrote a book called The Skeptical Environmentalist, appeared in that very same room and asked what you were talking about earlier at the end, just before news break, about the economy and what happens with the economy. Well, his question was, how much are you willing to sacrifice in your economy to support green efforts, and what sort of results do you expect to get what sort of return do you expect to get for your money? And will you sacrifice welfare programs, social programs, other types of...
Todd, I think we get it, and we are going to talk about economic impacts both directions. I would like to give our guest a chance to respond, and we've got full phones. So, Todd, thank you for your call. Diana Liverman, Todd, skeptical, and wants to know if we have any facts that aren't fudged.
Yes. So I think one answer to the question is that in this report, we don't just use one computer model to look at the future. There are now dozens of groups around the world all running their own models, and they're all converging on the same rough direction of where the warming is going. But I think the most important thing since a decade or so ago is that we're now seeing the warming, we're experiencing the warming. And so we do have a lot of empirical information about how a warmer climate can affect society and other species on the planet. So because we've already observed the 1 degree centigrade of warming, we have a lot of data on how warming of, you know, half a degree can affect different species. The question about the economic impacts is important, but I think what we see right now is that there's a lot less disagreement about the science. Most people in the U.S. Really believe that global warming is happening, and that's partly because they can see it in their own backyards, in their gardens. They can see it in terms of extreme events. What I think there is more disagreement about are the solutions and what the solutions would cost. So I think we need to separate the debate about whether warming is happening, which is pretty much settled, although there are people who do still feel skeptical about the science. We need to separate that discussion from the discussion about whether we should do something about it, and if so, what we should do.
There are going to be some impacts to the economy from rising temperatures, according to the study. The United States could lose roughly 1.2% of gross domestic product for every 1.8 degrees of warming.
Yes, there will be economic impacts, and we can see, even though we can't show that something like a hurricane is directly fingerprinted to global warming at the moment, if you look at the impacts of severe storms, whether it be in Florida or New York or Texas, those give us some indication of the sort of losses that we can experience with more extreme climates. But then there are a lot of things that are losses that it's challenging to put a dollar figure on. So how do you actually put a cost or put a price on the loss of coral reefs, or the fact that the types of birds you see in northern Wisconsin might be changing. People have a connection, a cultural connection to their local ecosystem, and they may feel a sense of loss if that changes that really is quite difficult to put a specific dollar amount on. So we can definitely estimate some of the economic damages, but there are other losses that are harder to put a dollar value on.
Well, the report has a figure for estimated damage from climate-related events at somewhere in the neighborhood of $54 trillion. Is that a worldwide number?
Yes, that's calculated worldwide, and it doesn't include some of these, what you might think of as intangibles or values that aren't in the economy at the moment.
Do we have a way to compare that to what it would cost us to implement the policy changes we would need to, in order to prevent this from happening?
Yes. So we do look at that in the report, although one of the things to keep in mind is the way the IPCC works is we don't do original research. What we're trying to do is synthesize all of the science that's been done since the last report. And one of the limitations in the economic costings is there actually haven't been many studies done. Although it is interesting that, of course, the Nobel Prize for Economics this week went to Bill Nordhaus, who's the person who developed the original economic costings for climate change. But in terms of the cost of avoiding those losses or avoiding those damages, the main estimate that we make is the investment that would be needed in the energy system to transition from a system that emits a lot of carbon dioxide to one that emits a lot less. And that's in the order of several trillion dollars a year. We're not trying to hide that this will have a cost responding to global warming. And the estimate is that it might require up to 2% of global GDP. So there is an expense, but we have to balance that against the costs of warming, and also that warming involves people's lives being lost, and
right,
as I said, an ecosystem being lost. So how we balance those two, I think, is one of the really big questions.
We have some callers who want to share what they are doing personally to try to reduce their carbon footprint. Chris in Port Wing will go to you first. Chris, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for this very important show. This is a very important and somewhat frightening study. I wanted to point out that, you know, for over 30 years up here in northern Wisconsin, we've been able to use solar and wind power for all of our electricity in our residence and our business. We have a building that heats itself year-round up by Port Wing just with solar energy. We've driven cars for the last 30 years that get more than 40 miles to the gallon, and right now it's pretty easy to find a car that gets 50 miles to the gallon, and we've been vegetarians for over 40 years. There's a lot of different alternatives, and if people want to get past the down frightened side and get into the solutions, there's a great book out there called Drawdown. It's the most comprehensive plan to ever propose to reverse global warming. It was edited by Paul Hawken and put out a couple years ago, and there are 100 solutions to not just stop emitting carbon and other greenhouse gases, but to actually draw out the carbon from the environment. So there's some very surprising things. Number four, and they're rated from 1 to 100 for the most effective. Number four is eating a plant-rich diet, which I kind of just mentioned, vegetarianism. But you don't have to be a vegetarian. You can just eat more plants and less meat.
Okay.
And it'll have
Chris,
a good impact.
We're getting real close to news time, and I want to take another call here. But thank you for that, and we'll get our guest response. Carolyn from Madison, you're next very quickly.
Yeah, grow trees and bushes and shrubs. Especially those that feed you, you know, that bear fruit and nuts and things, instead of lawns.
Oh, instead of lawns. Okay, and then you don't have to mow them either. So that would be another benefit, although we'd have to find some other way to exercise. Carolyn, thanks for that. Chris, thanks for your call. We'll get Diana Liverman's response to those two calls after the news. What are you what do you propose to do, if anything, to reduce your carbon footprint? 800-642-1234. We're talking about a recent report from a United Nations agency that says we're in big trouble if we don't get a handle on global warming before 2040. That's kind of our deadline here. Diana Liverman is with us, and you can be too. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Stay with us. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A recent report by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predicts we will see the most severe effects of climate change by the year 2040. We're talking with one of the authors of the report about the consequences of the rising temperatures and what we can do to reverse the impacts. Diana Liverman is one of the scientists who co-authored this recent report, and she's with us this morning. We had a couple of callers before the break, Diana, who were talking about what they're doing personally to try to reduce their our carbon footprint, solar power and wind power, things like that, changing diets, changing their lawn, their yard vegetation. These are all things that that people are doing.
Yes, and I was thrilled to hear the recommendation for the book Drawdown. Partly because it was co-written with one of my former students, Catherine Wilkinson, and that book definitely does suggest a whole range of things that can be done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And some of them are the ones, you know, perhaps not as much as you would expect. Just cutting food waste can be a very important way to reduce emissions, not just because carbon dioxide and other gases are emitted when we grow food, but also if it ends up in the landfill, then you get methane, which is another greenhouse gas. Planting trees is important, not just in our own backyards, but actually finding ways to support reforestation in other parts of the world as well. So those were both great examples of solutions. I think one of the things we talk about in the report is the question of feasibility. What are the barriers to doing things? How easy is it to do different things? And we talk about the sort of individual behavioral barriers that people have, but we also talk a lot about the more institutional, the economic barriers, the political barriers, and the technological barriers. And so I think even though there's things we can do as an individual, we also need to be thinking about more system-wide change. What can we do to influence companies and governments to shift to a decarbonized economy where we're not relying on fossil fuels?
One of the things your report talks about is overshooting the target. What does that mean?
Yes, that's a very important issue that we need to think about, because if we don't reduce emissions very dramatically over the next 10 to 12 years, then we're going to be keeping the greenhouse gas emissions going. And what that could mean is that the only way to get to 1.5 is to go through higher temperatures initially. So the idea of overshoot is that we could eventually get to a lower degree of warming, but in order to get there, we'll need to go through what I would call peak temperature. And the challenge there is if we look at how impacts increase as you go to higher temperatures, how can we help ourselves get through that overshoot? What sorts of adaptations would we need to make in order to survive peak warming? And in particular, if we're looking at ecosystems, so coral reefs probably couldn't survive that peak temperature. But other species might be able to keep going for long enough until things cool down again. So it's the idea of going, having to go through a higher temperature before we come back down to a more habitable temperature.
So some of this damage then would be irreversible. I mean, if the coral reefs disappear, there's no way to get them back, correct?
Well, there are some people working on sort of restoring them, but they wouldn't be able to do that until we got back down to a cooler temperature. But effectively, I think the report says 99% of corals would be gone, and it would be very challenging to get them back. I mean, the other issue that is a problem if we go up to even higher temperatures, 3 or 4 degrees, is if that triggers the collapse of the ice sheet. It could take millennia for the ice sheets to come back. So there are, and if you flood coastal cities because you've gone through higher warming, it would be, it's very difficult to get those cities back, especially if they're cities that have particular cultural heritage that we would want to protect.
Let's take some more calls. A lot of people want to join the discussion. We'll see how many we can get through here. Mark in Appleton, we will start with you. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. What's underreported is the methane time bomb in the Arctic. When the
Mark, I think you're in a bad cell. Let me have the guest address the methane issue, and we'll see if we can get you on a better line. Mark's concerned about underreporting of what he called the methane time bomb in the Arctic. Can you talk about that, please, Diana Liberman?
Yes. We don't discuss that in great detail in the summary for policymakers, which is the part of the report that's been receiving most attention. But in the full report, we do talk about the issue of methane and the way in which at warmer temperatures, the permafrost, the frozen ground in the Arctic, could melt. And that frozen ground actually contains a lot of frozen methane. So if you do get above 1.5 or 2 degrees, you can trigger the release of that methane, and that methane adds to the global warming effect. So you get a sort of an acceleration, you get a feedback that leads to even warmer temperatures. So the caller raises a very important issue that we do talk about in the report. But we're not exactly sure when that trigger happens at scale that would lead to the acceleration.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Milwaukee next, where Nate wants to join us. Nate, good morning.
Hi, thank you very much. I would say that if you wanted to look at an impact of global warming, recently, within the past couple months, we had the more intense rainstorms and flooding that went with them just this past summer. And I see global warming causing economic impacts wherever you've got things like out-of-control wildfires, as California had. And these events are causing a lot of damage. We're still paying for helping Houston recover. And one of the things I really think that we have a leg to deal with is the amount of lying that's been going on, and then we got to filter through about people trying to deny global warming, because frankly, I think they got paid to by people who think they'll be able to cash in and then let somebody else clean up the problem, when we as taxpayers are going to end up paying for this overall. One place, the earlier caller mentioned places to look, I would say even though it's not our own backyard, National Snow and Ice Data Center has an interesting history of over 30 years of records for Arctic sea ice extent, and you can just see the amount of ice every year go down.
Okay, Nate, thanks thanks for joining the conversation. Diana Liverman, Nate's talking about, we're already seeing local impacts here in Wisconsin.
Excellent point. As I was listening to your weather forecast and the news, I was thinking about the forecast of flooding in Wisconsin and the hurricane in Florida. And what we talk about in the report is we don't make the absolute link that that flooding or storms are for sure global warming. The point we make is that global warming dramatically increases the chances of flooding and the chances of hurricanes. So we will get more extreme events as things get warmer.
The elephant in the room, if you will, though, is the political challenge of getting the necessary steps taken. How do the politics of the United States and other world powers affect progress on climate change?
Well, in general, hardly any country has made the commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the rate and amount that we recommend in the report if we want to stay under 1.5 degrees. Costa Rica, a few other countries have committed to being carbon neutral, but most of the world's countries have made commitments to reduce emissions, but not enough. So the Paris Agreement that was made a few years ago, yes, countries agreed to reduce their emissions, but we estimated what that commitment would result in, and it still results in more than 3 degrees centigrade, which, you know, is 7 degrees Fahrenheit. So all of the world's countries need to do more, including the United States. Within the United States, I think the state that has done the most to be in line with the pathways we look at in the report is California, that has made a commitment to net neutral carbon over the time period that we're talking about, and has 100% commitment to moving towards renewables. So it can be done in this country. It does cost something, but we're starting to see that it could be possible.
Wow, I wish we had another whole hour to talk about this. How optimistic are you about what happens next?
That's a really challenging question. It depends on the day. I mean, what our report shows is that it's possible to stay under 1.5, but it requires such dramatic transformations that I really wonder if we're going to be able to cut emissions that fast. So I would say that I'm optimistic that we could perhaps have a cooler world through, but we would have to go through overshoot. So part of my focus as a researcher is thinking about how do we adapt to this warming that we're going to go through, and then hope that eventually we make the transition. The one area where I'd like to be more optimistic is with technology innovation.
Okay, and we'll have to leave it there, Diana Liverman, because we're out of time. Diana Liverman is professor in the School of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona. She's co-author of the report we discussed this hour. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Wisconsin voters in 16 counties and 2 cities will answer questions about the use and regulation of marijuana on their general election ballots this November. We discuss what the referenda are asking, what voters need to know, and what the results could mean for Wisconsin. Is there a marijuana referendum on your ballot? Have you decided how you'll vote? Do you have questions about what the marijuana referenda mean? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, the number to call to join our conversation. Mark Sommerhauser covers state government and politics for the Wisconsin State Journal. Mark, welcome to The Morning Show.
Great to be with you, John.
How many marijuana referenda are on the ballot in Wisconsin for this November general election?
Well, so we've got a total of 18. We've got 16 counties and two cities that are going to be having these referenda on their ballots. And when you add up the populations of all those parts of the state, you get more than half of the population of the state, about 3 million people.
What are these referenda asking?
So the referenda are different in each locality, but you can basically sort of group them into two categories. In a handful of counties, some of the most populous counties, Dane County, Milwaukee, Rock County, La Crosse County, they'll be asking about legalizing marijuana for recreational use. In 10 additional counties, there's going to be a referendum that's just going to focus on medical use of marijuana.
So these are these all advisory, and what does that mean?
Yeah, that's correct. So all these referenda are advisory referendums. And what that means is that they don't, you know, approval of these referendums would not change the laws in any of these areas regarding marijuana. It's simply meant to, you know, give a survey or a gauge of public opinion on the issue.
So who decides what referenda make it on the ballot?
So the county boards and the city councils in each of these municipalities approve these measures and were able to put them on the ballot through that mechanism. In most of these localities, you had residents of the counties and cities that came before the county boards and petitioned the county boards to put these questions on the ballot.
So how did those groups that are in favor of legalizing marijuana play a role in getting these referenda on the ballot, if any?
So there was a group called the Wisconsin Justice Initiative, which is a group of attorneys and other people who are, advocate on behalf of certain criminal justice issues that did play a pretty important role in just coordinating the effort to get, you know, all these similar questions on the ballot in all these different localities at the same time. And so there was an effort on their part, it sounds like starting primarily in Dane and Milwaukee and Rock counties, to get these referenda before the county boards there to try to get the county boards to approve them. The spokesperson for the group that I talked to said that the effort really kind of took off from there. They sensed a fair amount of enthusiasm and interest in getting these questions before voters in other parts of the state. And it sounds like from there, there was some activists in other counties and other areas of the state that kind of took the ball and ran with it in their own areas and went to their own county officials and asked to have these questions put before voters.
We're talking about advisory referenda around the state of Wisconsin on the subject of marijuana. Is there a marijuana referendum on your ballot? Have you decided how you'll vote? Do you have questions about what the marijuana referenda mean? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Mark Sommerhauser is with us this morning, and he covers state government and politics for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's been following this story. Okay, so let's say that all of these referenda pass. How will the results of the marijuana-related referenda be used? I mean, whether they pass or fail, what happens? What happens next, do you think?
Yeah, well, like we discussed, they're advisory only, so they don't change the law if they pass. But I think I think the impact of a passage would be. Hello?
Yep, no, that was a little digital artifact there. Go ahead.
Okay. So I think that passage would send a pretty clear signal about where voters in these counties stand on marijuana. We've already had indications. Public polling and so forth has indicated that, public sentiment is moving in the direction of legalization. But I think this would probably be the strongest signal yet that there is support. Obviously, conversely, if the referendums were to be rejected, that would send the opposite message about where public mm-hmm. sentiment is at on this issue.
Let's take a call here from Tom, who joins us from Madison. Tom, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. It used to be legalization of marijuana was just an academic, political thing for me. But then my mom ended up with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and her oncologist back then said he would have a source for her if she really wanted some marijuana. And after that, it occurred to me that the people that were fighting the legalization of marijuana, especially medical marijuana, were not just being involved in a political thing, they were basically taking medicine away from my mom. And that's when it really hit home. There are people that really need this. It is a very effective drug. It is something that should be a no-brainer. But because of the social stigma, there are certain people that are basically trying to keep medicine away from other people.
Tom, thanks. Thanks for your call, Mark. This in line with what polling shows about how Wisconsinites' positions are changing on this subject.
Yeah, I mean, Tom articulates an argument that we really do hear a lot, particularly on behalf of medical marijuana advocates. And for medical use, there's public polls show a very high level of support. I don't think the medical question specifically has been polled recently. By the Marquette poll, which is kind of the gold standard for public opinion. Recently, that poll is focused more on legalization. And, I think the sense is that for medical use, public opinion really is already there and has been for quite a while.
So what about on the campaign trail? Obviously, there's an election coming up. What have candidates been saying, maybe current Wisconsin legislators and their challengers? What are they saying about marijuana, if anything?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's something that candidates seem to be proactively trying to talk about, but certainly if you ask them about it, I spoke to a couple of lawmakers who have been active on this issue in the legislature, Senator LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee, as well as Representative Melissa Sargent from Madison. And they're co-sponsors of a bill in the legislature that would legalize marijuana for recreational use. And they have talked about the fact that they really feel like their view is that public sentiment already is in favor of legalization, and what they're hoping is that these referendums really show that to their fellow lawmakers.
Attorney General Schimmels called the referenda just a ploy to turn out Democrat votes.
Yeah, his spokesperson. Yeah, that's right. Attorney General Schimmel is among the folks who are, skeptical of marijuana legalization, particularly for recreational use, but as well as, for medical use. There is certainly a number of Republicans that I spoke to who have some skepticism, not only about, the merits of legalizing marijuana, but also the reasons why these referendums were put before voters. Representative John Nygren, who co-chairs the legislature's budget committee, also said, in his words, this is a coordinated effort by Democrats to get this on the ballot because they think it helps them in the election.
What about in the gubernatorial race? Have either Governor Walker or Tony Evers mentioned it at all?
Yeah, they have. So this is really an area of pretty strong contrast. Governor Walker has been one of the most outspoken voices here over the last 8 years opposing legalization of marijuana across the board, but both for recreational use, but also for medical use. In his words, he said that studies show that medically there are more viable alternatives to medical marijuana. And so he also cited law enforcement opposition to this, but he's been quite opposed. On the other side, you have Tony Evers, who's been pretty straightforward in his support for medical marijuana. He's been a little more circumspect about full legalization. He's said that the step that he would advocate if he were governor would be to have a full statewide advisory referendum on legalization. Mm-hmm. And if that were to pass, he would support it.
All right. Mark, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. It was great to be with you.
Mark Sommerhauser covers state government and politics for the Wisconsin State Journal. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson.